Thank you for coming out nice and early after the attendee party. Did you enjoy the party last night at least? Who went? Good? Good times. You're here, so it clearly wasn't too good of a time. That's the perfect balance. So we are going to talk about PowerShell remoting in depth. Here's kind of how I'm going to lay this session out. I've got sort of a little slide deck-based story with a lot of demo built into it. It's mostly demo. I'm going to kind of walk you through those basics. But when we hit the end of the slide deck, we're not done. That's just when I can hop back into the actual product and start digging even deeper. That's also where I'll really be able to answer questions. I find that remoting is extremely straightforward. It's very easy to understand. It's very easy to use if you are using sort of the easiest possible scenario. It's when you hit the real world and you start having to do weird stuff, which we all have to do, that's where it can get tricky. Not necessarily harder, but it's a little, it's a little more fiddly. You have to configure it a bit more. So I've got an entire virtual environment set up, lots of different machines, couple different forests, some standalone stuff. So whatever goofy scenario you think you might have to deal with when you get back home, now's a good time to ask about it, because I can at least point you in the right direction so that you know what you're going to have to deal with and what you're going to have to configure, and I can give you some of your options. Quick bit about myself before we get started. My name is Don Jones. I work for a company called Concentrated Technology. I'm a Windows PowerShell MVP award recipient for several years now. I also write the Windows PowerShell column for TechNet Magazine, so technetmagazine.com. It's free. It's translated into 14 languages. You can read that every month. There are some URLs on the slides here at the end that we'll get to for how to contact me, how to get to the Q&A forum that I run. So if you've got a question later, where my blog is, all that stuff will come on the slides. Please don't forget that these sessions are being recorded. As an attendee, you will have access to those recordings after the fact. You'll have access to the slides, the demos, everything else are all being recorded. So you'll have all of that. Don't feel that you have to scratch everything down in terms of syntax, because you'll be able to review it at your leisure when you get home. So let's kind of jump in. What is remoting? Remoting is a PowerShell utilization of what's actually a new foundational technology in Windows, both server and client. This technology today runs on Windows XP and newer on the client side, and Windows Server 2003 and newer on the server side. So it's actually part of the Windows management framework. If you go up to Microsoft's download website and you try to download PowerShell version 2, what you're actually downloading is the management framework core, and that includes this remoting technology. This is what Microsoft is moving toward for all of their administrative communications, right? So today, you pop open some random GUI console in the Microsoft Management Console, right, the MMC. You pop up some random snap-in, and it has to talk to a server. The protocol that it uses is almost completely random. There's so many different management protocols going on that it can be difficult to get them through firewalls. It can be difficult to manage all that stuff. It can be difficult to understand the security implications of all of it. A lot of them use remote procedure calls, or RPCs. Anybody ever try to get those puppies through a firewall? Yeah, it's awesome, isn't it? I just want to take a pencil and shove it in your ear. So the company realizes that it's kind of gotten out of control, and things have spread out as every different product team attempts to solve the problem. So a few years ago, what they said was, we're going to fix this. We're going to create a single unified communications channel for management traffic. And it is a protocol called WSMAN, Web Services for Management. As the name implies, it is a web service, which means it runs over what protocol? HTTP. Beautiful, slides through a firewall like butter. So you don't have to configure a bazillion different ports anymore. And the neat thing about this is it's implemented by one service, Windows Remote Management, or WinRM. If you've got the management framework installed on a machine, you can look at the list of services, and Windows Remote Management is right there. That guy acts as kind of a traffic cop. So it listens on whatever port and IP address you tell it to. It can do both HTTP and HTTPS, so you can get all kinds of encryption and mutual authentication, and we'll talk about those details. It only listens on that one port, takes in all the traffic, looks to see what application that traffic was addressed to, and then hands it off. So every single management thing running on a server can potentially utilize this. And now that we're kind of starting to see Microsoft going forward, right, we've got Windows 8 beta, we've got Windows Server 2012 beta, we're seeing more and more things start to utilize this. So everything's being nicely consolidated onto one port that we can easily secure, we can easily monitor, we can easily get through the firewall. It's HTTP, it loves proxy servers, so lots of different network scenarios are a lot easier. How many of you have a DMZ with servers in it? Yeah, right? How much of a pain is it to manage those servers without physically walking over to the little puppies? Right? Because you got to get through your firewalls and proxy servers. Much, much easier as things start transitioning to this protocol. So the protocol itself in WinRM is bigger than PowerShell. It's designed to do more than PowerShell. PowerShell, though, is a very important piece of it. PowerShell is one of the earliest, obviously, and one of the most important applications that utilizes this new technology. And because so many products administration are being built in Windows PowerShell now, PowerShell's ability to use this really opens up a lot of flexibility for you. So this is the type of stuff we're going to be talking about and demoing today. Now, again, WinRM is a general purpose traffic cop. It's designed to take traffic from all kinds of different places and route them to whatever service it is you're trying to talk to, whether that be PowerShell or WMI or whatever other crazy stuff you kids are running on your servers these days. Now, PowerShell, again, is just one thing. So PowerShell registers itself, says, hey, WinRM, my name is PowerShell, here's where I am. If any traffic comes in for me, let me know. That process is called creating an endpoint. So on your server machine, you might have dozens of endpoints. You might have several endpoints that are just for PowerShell, different sort of setups for PowerShell. Endpoints can create constraints on what they can do. Endpoints can be individually permissioned or ACLed so that you can decide who's allowed to connect to each endpoint. There's a ton of flexibility there. You can configure all of this locally on a per machine basis. How many servers do you have in your environment? Shout out a number. 500. Yeah, even at 500, I don't know if I'm excited about going around configuring them individually. Unless you've got that new intern net technology where you get a free kid from college to run around and do it. So you can configure a lot of this through group policy as well. So group policy is kind of cool. If you need to tweak things on an individual basis, PowerShell actually has a disk drive, a PS drive, called WSMAN, and that gives you access to the local configuration, and you can map a drive to a remote machine's WSMAN so that you can actually use remoting to configure remoting. Really, really cool stuff, and we will look at some of that as we go through. In fact, let me just show you real quick where some of the group policy-based stuff lives. I've got a domain controller over here. And I think I have a group policy open. Let's see, there it is. So we will go through administrative templates, Windows components, and near the bottom, there's really two things you're going to look for. Here is Windows Remote Management. That's broken down into client and server, well, client and service. Don't confuse that with client operating system. In a WinRM transaction, the client is the one who initiates things and wants to send things, and the service is the one that's listening and receives that and then does something with it. So you've basically just got some protocol stuff here. Trusted hosts is an important one that we'll talk about in a little bit. You get kind of the same little configuration bits on both sides. Now, PowerShell version 2 uses a version 2 of WinRM. There was a version 1. Version 1 by default listened on port 80 for HTTP and 443 for HTTPS before someone realized that that would be a problem on a web server that was already using those. So these last two settings here, turn on compatibility listener, essentially just turns on those older ports for WinRM's purposes. Otherwise, it does have a different set of ports that it uses now, and you'll see those when we dive into it. And of course, you can change all that stuff. This is all really super configurable. But that kind of lets you know where you can start to configure some of these things in WinRM for group policy. This is the Windows PowerShell specific piece of it. Sorry, I'm actually looking for remote shell. Windows remote shell. There we go. So you've got some other things here. You can configure idle timeouts, the maximum number of users who can connect to the endpoint, the maximum amount of memory that you're going to allow someone to consume. These things are by default set up pretty reasonably. This is not something I think you should dive right in and start ratcheting down. Play with it for a bit. Deal with this reactively. If you find that you've got too many administrators hitting on a particular machine, maybe look at why they all need to get on that machine. If you feel you need to restrict things like memory and processes to maintain a workload, do that on a more reactive basis. I've got several customers using this in fairly large environments with, you know, IT teams of 100, 200 people, tens of thousands of machines, and they've never had to mess with any of this. So you don't feel you have to go in and ratchet this down immediately. There's also some other places where these settings come into play and create sort of a precedence. And again, once we dive into the shell, we'll look at that. But I just wanted to quickly show you where this stuff is located in group policy, since that's obviously a good place to start with your centralized configuration. So we'll get the shell back up there and run through just a couple more slides. So that was the remote shell stuff. We looked at that. Security. You know, this is another protocol, right? It's another protocol on the network. Anybody work in an environment where even saying another management protocol freaks someone out somewhere? Yeah. So here's the deal. WinRM, its sort of baseline security state is transparent. In other words, this doesn't add or remove anything to your environment in terms of permissions or privilege or anything else. The way it works is when I create a connection to a server, my credential is delegated to that server, and whatever I ask it to do, it does as me. It's not running under some super powerful local system or anything else account, it's running as me. Now, that does not mean that my credentials are being transmitted across the network. We're not transmitting passwords across the network. It's Kerberos. So there are tickets involved, there's encryption. This is the safest form of credential delegation that human minds have been able to come up with. This is the way your network already operates, in fact. Just a lot of people don't realize that this is all happening under the hood. So you're not going to be able to do anything you couldn't do 10 other ways. Could you use remoting to go in and wipe out every user in Active Directory? Yeah, if you have permission. But there's 5 other ways you could have done that. And if you have auditing in your network, doing this with remoting will still trigger all the normal audit stuff. This is no different than any other tool, so it's transparent. You can't do anything you don't normally have permission to do. Everything you have permission to do, you can do. Whatever security you've got set up is all the same. Now, what will sometimes freak out the security people is, well, you know, it's another management protocol. I find there are 2 types of IT security people in the world. The first type just wants to understand what's happening. They want to understand what's going on. They want to understand how this is secured. They just want to see it. They want to know what they might need to do to audit it. They just want to understand, and then they're fine with it. Those folks you can work with. Help them understand. Educate them. Help them educate themselves. This is a better protocol, the remote desktop protocol. This uses a fraction of the overhead on your servers that spinning up an entire graphical environment does. This is the way you're going to be managing your network. This stuff is enabled by default in Server 2012 because you can't manage the server without this. In fact, the new Server Manager console uses remoting to configure remote machines and the local machine. It actually loops back and manages itself via remoting. So if you have the other type of security guy who says, well, we can't do this because I'm in security and blah, 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 blah. You can work with those guys too. It just requires a long pole and a tall cliff. But explain to them that saying we can't use this protocol is like saying we can't use Ethernet. All right? This is not an option. This is the way the product works, and if you don't like it, go buy a Mac or something and don't network it. So this is something that you need to start thinking about how this is going to fit into your environment. If you need to have a conversation with security folks, now's the time to have that conversation, because more and more and more and more is going to be built on this, and it is going to become less and less and less optional. Today, can you get away without this? Yeah, sure, no problem. In a year? No. So start figuring it out now. And we'll talk more about security stuff as we go on too. This is a bit that really messes people up a lot. It can get a little bit confusing, but here's the trick. Remember I told you that when I go from my client to my server, so from my computer to computer A, my credential is delegated across the network. By default, you can only do that once. I cannot ask computer A to then delegate my credential again to a third computer. That's the second hop, right? Me to computer A is the first hop, computer A to computer B, that's the second hop. That won't work. If you try it, you'll start getting access denied. If I go from my computer to computer A and then ask it to talk to a secured networked file share, that won't work either. My credential can't go any further by default. There are a lot of scenarios where you are going to want to be able to delegate across multiple hops, and you can. You just have to turn it on. And the protocol is called CredSSP. This is available in Vista and later. So if you're trying to do this with purely XP and Server 2003 machines, best of luck, probably won't work. Time to upgrade. So Vista and later supports this. There's actually several different configuration steps that need to occur. There is one simple command that will do it for you, and it's called, surprisingly, let's do it on my client machine here. Enable WSMAN cred SSP. So let's look at the help for that real quick rather than actually running it. You do have to specify the role. You can see there's not a lot of parameters here. There are two roles, the client and the server. The client is your machine, the machine that is delegating the credential. The server is the next machine on the hop to which you are delegating your credential. When you run this on the server, you just run enable WSMAN cred SSP minus role server. That's it. On your client, you have to run enable WSMAN cred SSP minus role client minus delegate computer, and you have to give it the name of the computer you want to allow delegation to. That can include wildcards. So if your domain name is company.local, you could say star.company.local. That would enable your machine to delegate credentials to all other machines in your domain. The command only modifies your local computer policy. It does not go out and modify group policy. I would suggest that in most environments, setting up that list of allowed delegates makes more sense in group policy so that you can centrally manage it for the whole environment. So that's a manual step you have to take. If you read the full help for this command, it does a really good job of detailing exactly what changes it makes. So you could go through and do all of those manually if you needed to replicate it and you didn't want to go around and run this command on every single machine. It also tells you where in the policy you need to make that change. So again, it just changes it per computer. You can go in and change it. Once you set this up, then the double hop thing problem goes away. This enables your credential to be delegated across that extra hop. Any short questions on the cred SSP thing? We're not going to come back to it much. So if there's a question on it, I want to try and nail it now. Yeah. Is the ability to run the command in a GPO? No. Can you use group policy to configure everything that this winds up configuring? Yes. In other words, the help lists like the four or five things that this does. You can do all of those things via a group policy. It will not do it in the GPO for you, though. Is this one of the things your security team is going to freak out about? Yeah, possibly, but just because they're security people and it's their job. The only thing that I, as a security person, would get freaked out about is if somebody did minus delegate computer star. You need to not just set it up so that you can listen to this. You don't want to just send your credentials to any random computer on your network. Right? Because as an attacker, all I have to do then is get on your network, spoof some DNS, and I can get hold of your domain admin credential. So you need to manage that list to only include trusted computers. That's the security concern. Just make sure it's trusted computers. Now look, I don't have a problem with star.domain.whatever, because if an attacker is able to get into your domain and get a computer account in your domain, you've got bigger problems than this. You've already been owned. So just manage that trusted, that delegate host list, and I think you're probably fine. Okay.
How about non-domain?
Hold that. We're going to get to non-domain. Non-domain is the exciting part. We'll get there. Could you automate the running of this? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you could write a script that pushed this out once remoting was set up, provided you didn't need the second hop to be working to run that script, obviously, since this is, you know, chicken and egg. But yeah, there's lots of ways you could automate this. Okie doke. So that's the second hop. Encryption. WinRM, when I do the easy setup in a second, it is going to set itself up with an HTTP listener on port 5985. That's its default port. You can change that, but it's a good port. It doesn't conflict with anything that Microsoft gives you, at least. It can be set up to also, or alternately, listen on HTTPS. Its default port for that is 5986. So understand something about HTTPS, right? You guys know that HTTPS is supposed to do two things for you, right? Encryption is the one we all get excited about. But it also does mutual authentication through a trusted intermediary called a certification authority. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Just understand that there's two things you get out of that SSL. Applications that are giving traffic to WinRM can apply their own encryption, and they can apply their own compression too. So you can have a lot of different levels of security going on. I don't want you to think that just because we're using HTTP, that we're spewing sensitive data onto the network in clear text. That is not necessarily the case. It just means the channel has not been encrypted, but what's inside the channel still might be, depending on what application you're using. And I'll show you some command line switches and all that'll make that a little clearer. You, however, are in full control of how this gets used. This is a neat little fact I ran across. You guys know who BeyondTrust is? Yeah, a few folks? There's probably other companies that will do something similar to this, but because this uses HTTP, you can actually go into your computer, tell it that for port 5985, I want you to use this proxy server. So all of your remoting traffic gets directed to this proxy server, and this is one of the companies that creates a special proxy. They look at the traffic and run through a set of policies to determine if you are allowed to run that command on that computer, and then they log the command that was run. And then if you are allowed, they proxy your request off to that server, and they can even run it under alternate credentials, so you can do stuff you don't have permission to do. So just the fact that this is based on these standards means third parties, or even you, your own software developers, can start to do a lot of really cool, flexible, different things with it. I call this out because I think it's so neat that they're just tapping right into how these protocols are supposed to work. And if you've got a need, if you're in an environment where you're like, look, we've just got to log every single command, and the product doesn't do that by default, well, it's okay. There are ways to do that. If you've got a particular vertical need like that, there are vendors and software developers who can help you do that. I just think it's really neat. So, enabling remoting. Let me just show you this. Enable PS remoting. All you have to do. This actually tells you what it's going to do. It is going to make sure that the WinRM service is set to start automatically. That is something you could do with a group policy if you wanted to automate this for your entire environment. This is going to start the WinRM service or restart it if it's already running. This will set a Windows firewall exception for 5985, so that your incoming traffic can make it through the firewall. Here's a huge caution. If you are doing this on a client computer, and that client computer has any of its current networks identified as a public network, you know, in Windows 7 and 8, you can and even Vista, you can say this is a public network, this is a work network, this is a home network or whatever. If you've got any networks set to public, the Windows firewall will not permit the exception to be created. So you will get an error message on a client if you've got that. Just be aware of that. Most of you are probably going to do this at work. Most of your computers will be plugged in and identifying themselves as in a domain profile, and so it'll work. The other thing this will do is set up a listener for HTTP, port 5985, on all local IP addresses. So this is kind of the do everything all at once. Now, you'll see here that I have run this in the past. Remoting was already enabled on this machine. Does not hurt to run it again. And now you're going to see it set up several different endpoints for Windows PowerShell. I'm hitting yes rather than yes to all, so you can see each one of these. So it's setting up different endpoints for Windows PowerShell. Now, if I change to that WSMAN drive, let's see, what have I got here? In the listener section, there's the HTTP listener. Oops. So this is letting me see the properties of this. You can see it's an HTTP listener. It's listening on 5985. It has bound itself to all of my local IP addresses, both IPv4 and IPv6. So it's simple. You run it. It just works. It's nice and easy. If we run a get PS session configuration, this is going to list all of the endpoints, which PowerShell calls a session configuration, that are set up. So you can see I'm on a 64-bit machine. So it has set up the Microsoft.PowerShell endpoint, which will run 64-bit shell. But it's also set up a Microsoft.PowerShell 32 endpoint, which will run the 32-bit version. So if I've got some extension or something that's only available as 32-bit, that's sort of my backward compatibility listener. And it has set up another one for PowerShell workflow. So I'm using PowerShell version 3 right now. This is a beta. If you do this exact same command in PowerShell version 2, you won't get quite this same list, but it still sets everything up for you. Cool? So good question. Where would this be under GPO? There's several different, right, so there's four steps that this command completed. So each of those things has to be done if you're going to set this up in GPO. Here's where to go. PowerShell has a help file. Oh, you know what? This is version 3, so it's probably, oh, it is on here. Excellent. Help about remote troubleshooting. How many of you like to read help files? How many of you don't like to read help files? Awesome, get over it. This contains most of your edge case instructions. So it's going to talk about how to set the service status in a GPO, how to set the firewall exception in a GPO, how to enable automatic configuration of listeners in a GPO. So all four of those steps that that command accomplished, this is going to tell you how to do pretty much everything you need to do in a GPO. It's not one step, it's several steps, but it walks you through all of them. So if you don't like reading help files, too bad. Get promoted out of harm's way quickly because you're going to be reading a lot of help files with PowerShell. It's good for you. So that is like the best resource I can offer. I will have another couple of web-based resources later that I'm going to refer you to. I've got a couple of URLs that I'll give you that have got some free guides that you can get to. I'm working on one myself that's going to really provide a lot of detail. So I'll give you those URLs when we hit the end. And again, they're in the slide decks, which you guys will all have access to. So you only need to really run this on machines that you want to receive incoming connections. So a lot of folks are going to think, well, okay, that's fine. I'll do that on my servers. Let me suggest to you that it is a good idea to think about enabling this on all of your client computers as well. Here's why. How many of you have Windows 7, like at least on your desktop? If not, okay, that's a lot of you. How many of you have played with the troubleshooting packs? A few folks. Excellent. Most of you probably have, actually. You might not have realized it. You know, when you run into a network problem and you get the little bubble pop up at the bottom, it says click here to troubleshoot the problem, and it comes up with a wizard. That's a troubleshooting pack. So let's talk about, how many of you have worked the help desk at once in your, okay. So tell me if I'm right or wrong here. Here's how the conversation with the help desk goes. Somebody calls up, hi, how you the help desk, how can I help you? Yep, okay, so you're having a problem, your computer will not display the Aero glass interface, and you wanna, okay. Yep, click the troubleshoot, okay, click next, click the second radio button. No, that's the little round one. No, the second one, number two. No, click back, click, what's on the screen, reboot. Right? Is that not how it goes? So a lot of folks don't realize it, but these troubleshooting packs are actually Windows PowerShell thingies. And there's a module called Troubleshooting Pack that lets you run them. And when they're surfaced to an end user, it's a GUI wizard. When they're surfaced through Windows PowerShell, they're not. So this is in Windows Diagnostics System. And this is a client, so I should have the Arrow one as an example. About the only one you can't do this way is networking, because, well, networking. But when you run these things from the command line, and you type it correctly, rather than getting a pop-up wizard, you get a little command line menu. And you'll see it pop up in just a second. So I want you to think about this. Next time somebody calls from the help desk, you don't have to walk them through a GUI. You don't have to get them to do a remote assistance request. You don't have to get them to approve you taking over their screen. You just remote in behind the scenes in Windows PowerShell, and you run your little troubleshooting pack. There's actually an SDK for these troubleshooting packs. You can make your own. So if you've got some corporate application, and you know, once in a while it breaks, and the way to fix it is we go delete this registry key. Anybody ever walk an end user through deleting a registry key? Yeah, only once. You're like, no, I'll just come over there. So you can write these little things, and you can see this is doing a lot of troubleshooting, and it'll also do a lot of problem resolution as well. There's a lot of great arguments for having this on every single one of your computers, servers and client computers, because you can get in. They can't see what you're doing. No touchy. You don't have to share what you're doing. You're not giving away secrets. Because right, the first time you walk them through the wizard, the next time they try to do it on their own because they think they can master this now. And then they break everything and you have to reimage the desktop. So with this, they can't see what you're doing. So I think there's a lot of great arguments for having this enabled on all of your client computers as well. Give it some thought at least. I'm going to let that continue churning away. We'll flip back over and run through a couple more slides here. So that's enabling it. In a single domain environment where you and the computer you want to talk to are all in the same domain, or even trusting and trusted domains, this setup pretty much just works. Everything happens and you're good to go. There's a couple of little caveats that we'll get into. Here's that quick reminder for help about remote troubleshooting. Most of the time, people, I run a Q&A forum and folks will ask me questions, and about 8 times out of 10, the answer's in there. They just didn't want to read through it. So I kind of try and force them to read through it. There's another really good guide. I created a shortcut link to it. It's a free guide. You do have to register for the website to get into it. So it's free, but you have to have a login account, which is unfortunate. But it's a really good guide to setting up and using remoting. I'm also working on a guide. I'll give you a place that you can look for that once it's going to go up. I'm hoping in maybe 2 or 3 weeks that'll be available. Here's one of the biggest caveats that people run into, though. When you want to access a remote machine, you have to use its real name as it appears in Active Directory, meaning that name must be resolvable by DNS to an IP address so that you can make the physical TCP connection, and that name has to be how the machine identifies itself on its computer account in Active Directory, because there's mutual authentication happening here. The mutual authentication part is really important, and I can't stress it enough. You are sending your credential to the remote computer. You do not want someone to just spoof DNS. You think you're hitting DC1, but you're really hitting I'm going to wreck your entire company computer. So the mutual authentication is important, and it's why you have to use the real computer name. If you are in a situation where the real computer name won't get you there, it won't resolve, and you have to use a DNS CNAME alias or you have to use an IP address, you're going to have to fiddle with remoting just a little bit more. And I'm going to show you how to do that. So just be aware. Is anybody in a situation where you might have to use an IP address? Or yeah, most of us, there's at least one or two machines. Well, yeah, I'm going to show you. The same fiddling that makes an IP address or an alias work will also make a non-domain machine work. It's the same process you're going to have to go through. And you really have two choices. So we'll get there. Let's take a look at what this looks like. Let's push the correct button. All right, so we're going to exit that little troubleshooting pack. There's really, on a day-to-day basis, you're going to find yourself probably using two different modes for remoting. Hello. It's gone all black. There it is. The first one is enter PS session, give it a computer name. Let's see, I think my computer name is DCA. We'll see if that works. This is called one-to-one remoting. You can see that the PowerShell prompt has changed. I have made the first hop. I now have a prompt on the remote computer. This is sort of PowerShell's idea of SSH. If anybody's ever used SSH in a Unix environment, this is PowerShell's concept of SSH. A little different, but the same basic idea, one-to-one. This has actually created what's called a PowerShell session. So that represents the connection between me and that computer. And when I exit PS session, can't figure out if it's, there we go. It tears down that connection. There is no longer a copy of PowerShell running on the remote computer. I'm no longer connected to it. There's nothing's left over. So this tears it, brings it up, uses it, tears it down. Pretty straightforward. Another way that you can utilize remoting is invoke command. And you can do one of two things. You can give it a, let's do a get process, just something quick and easy. You can either give it a script block, which has whatever command or commands it is you want to run on the remote machine, or if it's a bunch of commands and you've got them in a script file, you can give it a file path. Your computer will read the contents of that and transmit the contents to the remote computers so that they execute it. This can be run on multiple computers. Any way you have of feeding it multiple computer names will work. This is the simplest, just a comma-separated list. I could have it read those names out of a file. I could have it search Active Directory for computer names. There's a lot of different ways you can feed it computer names. What this is going to do is create a connection to each of the remote computers, send my command over to those remote computers. They are going to execute the command. The resulting objects will be serialized into XML, which is just text, so it transmits over the network very nicely. My computer will get that XML and deserialize it back into objects, so it will look like the output just shows up on my screen. PowerShell is going to add a couple of little properties to it, including one called PS computer name. So that'll let me see what computer each result actually came from. You can see that's in the last column as it starts scrolling through the results there. So I can then utilize that to sort these things or group them out or spin them off into different sections. Again, though, because I specified a computer name, this is bringing up the connection, utilizing it, and then tearing down the connection. So it's cleaning up for me. Couple of little rules about this thing. Let's just look at the help. That's an easy way to see it. By default, this will only talk to 32 computers simultaneously. That is its default throttle limit. You can change that. If you give it more than 32 computers, it just queues up the rest of them, and as it finishes one, it goes and grabs the next one. If you've got an admin workstation that you're working on and it's got 64 gigs of RAM and tons of processor power and just it hovers an inch off your desktop, it's so awesome, then feel free to bump that throttle limit up. The only performance hit from bumping up the throttle limit is on your machine, the one you're sitting at, because it basically has to run a thread of PowerShell for every machine it talks to simultaneously. So if you want more threads, you bump up the throttle limit. Otherwise, it'll just queue everything up and talk to them 32 at a time, or whatever you specify. If you wanted it to use SSL, you would use the minus use SSL switch, which is on here somewhere. My eyes are crossing. It's too early in the morning. If you wanted to have it use a different authentication protocol, you can use that. Let's see if I can get to the file path switch. That's down in there as well. You can specify an alternate credential. So if you are not logged on to PowerShell as the user that has permission to do whatever it is you're doing, you can specify an alternate username. It'll prompt you for the password, and that is the credential that will be delegated across the network. You can specify an alternate port. There's use SSL. So all kinds of cool stuff. One thing people miss a lot is this one, session option. There's a lot of default configuration for that connection that you create. So if we look at help new PS session option, this is the command that would create a new option. And you can see now there's a lot of lower level configuration things you can change. You can give it proxy access, you can turn off compression, turn off encryption. Give it the credential for your proxy server, specify the maximum amount of data that gets received, lots of kind of low-level configuration things if you need to do that for that particular connection. So this is an extremely configurable thing to be able to play with. The default settings tend to work for most situations, but when they don't, you've got a lot of ability to go in here and change those settings to whatever it is you need. Now, if you need to do the weird thing where you're talking to an IP address or to a computer name that isn't in your domain or to a computer name that isn't the one the domain has for the computer, you've got two options. Option number one is to set up an HTTPS listener on that machine, which means installing an SSL certificate on it. How many of you have a PKI? Awesome. So SSL certificates are easy if you have a PKI. If you don't, you can go to a commercial CA and get one. You can spin up your own PKI, whatever you want to do. That SSL certificate gives you encryption, yes, but it gives you that mutual authentication. Because you've taken Active Directory out of the loop, SSL stands in for that and gives you that mutual authentication to make sure that the server you're hitting is the one you intended to hit. So you're not delegating your credential to some random imposter. So that's a good choice. When you want to do that, when you run your remoting command, you specify minus use SSL. That tells it to switch over to the SSL port. And you must also specify a minus credential, which is in here someplace. If you're going to use SSL, you have to specify minus credential. So that's option one. If you need to talk to a machine and Active Directory can't provide the mutual authentication for you, set it up with an HTTPS listener, put an SSL certificate on it, connect to it with minus use SSL and minus credential. Cool? That's step one. Option two, if you prefer, and this is something that you can manage in group policy as well. Let's see. Let's go to my client. You've got this trusted hosts. You can see that I've populated that with an IP address. So I've already been experimenting with this on this machine. This tells me that if I specify a computer name of 10.160.123.220 and I specify a credential, if you're going to use this trick, you also have to do minus credential, it will skip mutual authentication for that host. You can use wildcards in here. So you can, but please don't use the wildcard just a plain star. Do not just shut off mutual authentication. I swear that is just, you know, you go up to people's blogs sometimes, and you wish that the blog had a contact me page so you could find out whose neck to wrap your hands around. Putting a trusted host of star will make the error messages go away, but so will closing your eyes and singing loudly. Right? What it is doing is shutting off most of the security checks that prevent your credentials from being delegated to an imposter, to an attacker. So you can use wildcards in conjunction with other stuff, star.rcompany.com or whatever else. IP address ranges, if you want to, that's fine. If you know they're trusted internal IP addresses and that no one can possibly pick one up because you're using 802.1x or some kind of switch level authentication, fine. But just think about that. Don't set yourself up to a point where you can just be delegating your credentials to an unknown machine. This trusted host list shuts off the mutual authentication for all the hosts that are listed there. So yes, it's an easy way to make the error messages go away, but this is the type of thing that makes a reasonable IT security person get a little crazy. So you know, just think about that. For non-domain machines, again, SSL or trusted hosts, either of which option also requires a minus credential parameter so that you can specify the credential that's going to work with that machine. You specify the credential on your remoting command. So enter ps session or invoke command has a minus credential parameter. So you would just type it. Let's see. Enter ps session. I'll give it a computer name, DCA, credential. Oops. I think my domain is company minus or slash administrator. Just like that. It'll then pop up and prompt you for the password. Can you specify what in the GPO? No. You cannot specify a credential in the GPO, nor can you provide the password on the command line, because that would be a clear text password, and that's crazy talk. So no, if you're going to use this command with a credential, you need to specify it. You can't make that a default via group policy. Let's stick with this for right now. any other questions about that authentication piece or using those two commands? Enter PS session is the one-to-one. Invoke command lets you push a command out to multiple machines. They run it. The results come back to you. Cool? Yes. Can you do what with a script? Can you do a script so it continues after restart? What you are probably looking for is a new feature in PowerShell version 3 called Workflow that is essentially a script that is designed to do multiple tasks which may need to survive a network outage or wait for a machine to restart and stuff like that. So PowerShell actually hands that off to Windows Workflow Foundation to coordinate all those steps and make sure it's logged and everything else. You could certainly do that in version 2, but you would have to sort of fiddle that out yourself, you know, have an auto run or something hacky and awkward. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it would be hard. Okay. So that's the one-to-one. We also looked at the one-to-many, which is invoke command. Troubleshooting. Troubleshooting this can be a little difficult slash tricky. I'll show you some of the tools that are available. One of the neat commands that I've started playing with in version 3 is called test wsman. And you give it a computer name. And this is essentially it's a ping for this particular protocol. It only requires that the protocol be up, running, and reachable. It does not require that you authenticate to it. This isn't letting you do anything. It's just telling you, hey, the service is there, the service is running, the service is accepting requests. It works. So this is a good first troubleshooting step. There is also a module called PS Diagnostics. This is a really kind of cool little available tool you can use. What I usually do is within that, there's a command called enable WS, let's see, enable PSWS man combine trace, I think. There it is. You run that command, it turns on tracing. It starts to create a trace file. Then you run whatever remoting commands it is you're trying to run. Then you disable PSWS man combine trace, shut the tracing off. And then you can either use a PowerShell command to pull the events out of that trace file, or you can just go into Event Viewer and look at them. This is probably the deepest level of diagnostics that you can get out of it. I have found it to be reasonably useful in figuring out where the problem went wrong. But the error messages are actually not that bad, particularly the ones that I'm seeing in version 3. They're pretty clear. I told you guys I'm working on a sort of an extended guide to remoting, and I'll tell you where you can look for that once I finally finish it, which will hopefully be in a couple of weeks. One chapter of that is a bunch of annotated traces for all the different major failure situations. So it will tell you, if this is what you're seeing in the log, this is what to check first, because this is probably where the problem is. So it'll walk you through using all these commands and everything else, as well as what the logs look like. The log is a lot of information. Don't freak out when you see it the first time and you're like, wow, there's 800,000 messages here. There are certain ones to look for, certain event IDs that you can look for that kind of get you to the source of the problem a little bit more quickly. So between that sort of that pingish command, testwsman, and being able to use this log, it's relatively easy to figure out where the problem is. You know another trick, though? How many of you remember telnet? If you don't have a command line telnet utility on your computer, get one, because HTTP, under the hood, most internet protocols are really just telnet at the end of the day. It's just a simple way of transmitting. And HTTP is no different. Therefore, this is no different. So you can tell it to telnet to a computer on the WinRM port. And if it at least, I don't even have the client on here. If it at least makes the connection, then you know it's not the firewall, it's not TCP traffic, it's not a proxy server. All the low-level networky stuff, DNS, everything else gets taken out of the equation at that point. So that's a really, really good troubleshooting step to remember. It's something that I used to do all the time, and it seems like folks have kind of forgotten that it's an option. But it's definitely an option. So you can get yourself a little telnet client and just try and hit the port. And you'll see gobbledygook. You know, you're basically going to see HTTP request headers, but that tells you you're there. You got that far. The rest of it, you can start looking at things like permissions and whatnot. So get PS session configuration, format list star, breaks down how each individual PowerShell endpoint has been configured. And one of the most important bits is that security descriptor SDDL, security definition descriptor language. Anybody know how to read those? Me neither. So here's another fun command you can play with. Set PS session configuration. Give it the configuration name you want to play with. I'll just put Microsoft.PowerShell. And tell it to show the security descriptor UI. I'm a big fan of the command line, but sometimes a GUI is just the best way to present the information. So I am not actually going to make changes, but what this is going to do is read the endpoint's security configuration and construct a normal-looking dialog box. Now, how many of you know how to read one of those? Yeah, exactly. So if you're concerned that permissions might be the issue, this is a good way to check the permissions on the endpoint to see who is allowed in. As you can see, the default configuration for these is just to allow administrators full control over it. So the default remoting configuration is admins only. Being able to come in here and play with this. Now, if you needed to make changes, the good news is we're running a set command. So if you make any changes and hit OK, it will save that new configuration onto the listener and onto the endpoint, and you will have presumably addressed whatever your problem is. So let's not run the rest of that so I don't mess up my config. So that's kind of the Really, I think the only problems I see people deal with are authentication, permissions on the endpoint, and then just pure connectivity. Pure connectivity is what it is. If you're not already familiar with how to troubleshoot firewall port issues and stuff like that, just you're going to have to gain that skill. This is how you can troubleshoot the permission on the endpoint. And in terms of the authentication, there's one other thing I'll kind of turn you on to. Remember I showed you this new PS session option? This creates an option object. Oops, didn't mean that. Meant help. This creates a session option that you can pass to invoke command or to enter PS session. And two that you might find useful are in here. Skip CA check. This is if you're making a connection to a machine that's using SSL. Its certificate, its SSL certificate, has to be issued by a certification authority that your machine trusts. If you can't make that happen, skip CA check will skip that. Now, what you're saying is, I don't really care if the SSL certificate is forged or not. I want to send my credentials off to that computer anyway. So, I mean, be aware that, yes, it will make an error message go away, but there's a security risk. Skip CN check. If you are attempting to connect to a computer via SSL and you are typing mycomputer.company.com, the SSL certificate has to contain that exact name, mycomputer.company.com. If it doesn't, you'll get a CN or canonical name mismatch error. Skip CN check turns that error off. Again, that says, no, even though he has an SSL certificate that was issued to a completely different machine, I'm going to trust it anyway. Make sure that you actually do trust it and you know you're hitting the right machine. The last one is skip revocation check, where Windows is checking to see if the certificate was revoked or not. That can just create sometimes performance problems if you're in an environment where you don't have your PKI set up properly or you can't use the OCSP protocol to check revocation status. Turning that off sometimes will speed things up a little bit. But again, you're saying, I don't care if his certificate was revoked because it was fraudulent. I'm going to connect anyway. Makes the error message go away, but there is a security implication. Just make sure that you understand what you're doing. So those are also good troubleshooting steps, particularly if you're getting error messages that say, well, the host name didn't match, or, well, the certificate wasn't trusted. If you can quickly test it with one of those skips and that resolves the error, then you know what you need to do to actually fix the problem. Trust the certificate, fix the canonical name, whatever it is. Make sense? Lot of low-level little detail things in this remoting stuff. Again, at a very high level within a domain, it all just works when you turn it on. But when you start getting into these edge cases and these sort of niche situations, it definitely gets a lot more technical. Does it look in the default certificate store? So when you set up an HTTPS listener, you have to install the SSL certificate into the computer account's personal certificate store. The easiest way to do that, honestly, is with the certificates snap-in and the MMC because it makes it very straightforward. Problem is when you just double-click a certificate, it wants to put it in your personal store, and that won't work. What you do is you get the certificate in the store, open up its properties, copy its thumbprint. You know, it's got a little hash like an MD5 hash. That is what you give when you set up the listener. You say, I'm going to set up an HTTPS listener. Here's the thumbprint of the certificate I want you to use. And that's how it goes in and finds the cert, binds it to the listener. And that is what makes it all work. It's a kind of a multi-step process. That's one of the big things I set out to document when I started doing this guide. So it's like 60 screenshots of how to do every single bit. How many of you have ever done an SSL certificate on like IIS? Okay, so you know that the first step is you run the little wizard to create the certificate request, the CSR, and you paste that into your CA, and they use that to issue the certificate. Well, PowerShell doesn't have a way to create a CSR. So the first thing you're going to have to do is get a tool that can create a valid CSR on the machine that you can take to your CA to get a certificate, and I link to a tool and everything else in there, too. So it's a pretty complete walkthrough. So those are some troubleshooting steps. Do keep in mind, this is the way forward. If you've got an environment where you think, wow, I'm going to have to do a lot of work in terms of getting certificates in place, and I'm going to have to start thinking about our name resolution and how I'm going to get to different machines, now's a good time to start having those thoughts. Once Server 2012 comes and starts moving into your environment and more Microsoft products start to build on this remoting technology, you need it to work. So this is a good time to figure it out while it's not a crucial mission-critical need, but you will have to have this. It is not going to be optional. You are getting a warning period now to figure it out while you can live without it, because you will not be able to live without it forever. Does that kind of make sense? I mean, at least, you know, forewarned is forearmed, right? A couple of URLs. This is my Twitter feed. I don't know how many of you are Twitterers. I'm not even sure I use it right. I don't tweet about my lunch or anything like that, or when I get a haircut. It's all PowerShell stuff. Once I get this remoting guide published, that's where you'll see it first. You'll also see it on my blog. So if you're more comfortable consuming an RSS feed to a blog, that's where I'll link to that. This guide is going to be free. I'm putting it out under a Creative Commons license, so you can post it yourself, you can forward it to anyone you want to. I just want it out there. It's a complete walkthrough for all of these edge cases, managing trusted hosts, setting up the SSL stuff. Only rather than just telling you the easy way to make the error messages go away, I walk you through why, so that you can make a smarter security decision on your end. I do write for TechNet magazine, so there's a link to that column. And if you want to ask me questions, there's a link to my Q&A forum. When I'm on the road at a conference, it's kind of a 24-hour turnaround type thing I try and hit. If I'm at home, I usually try to answer a question within a couple hours. So I try really hard. And you're more than welcome to hop up and answer questions on your own, too. I'd certainly appreciate the help. I've written a couple of books about PowerShell, Learn Windows PowerShell in a Month of Lunches. It's designed for beginners, walks you through PowerShell step by step. If you're ready to move on to the next step, Windows PowerShell Scripting and Toolmaking is a very small self-published book about how to create your own tools in PowerShell. If you want the e-version, it's like $4. So I tried to keep it as cheap as possible. That's on Kindle and the Apple bookstore and everything else. I've got like two more kind of crucial things I want to show you, but I want to make sure that if there's any outstanding questions, that I take care of those. So anything on your mind right now you want to ask? The troubleshooting packs don't exist in XP. That architecture was introduced in Vista. So practically speaking, Windows 7 is probably what most people are going to have, but they don't exist. That's not a PowerShell feature. It's an OS feature that PowerShell consumes. Still got a lot of XP out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. How many of you have a lot of XP out there? Yeah, start thinking about that upgrade process, because PowerShell version 3 is not going to be available for XP. Version 3 does cross-communicate with 2, right? From a remoting perspective, the two versions can speak to each other, but XP is limited by what the OS can do, and it's a 10-year-old operating system at this point, so it's not quite as up to speed. And version 3 will not install on it. So, how many of you have users in your environment that you like to be able to give some delegated administration to, but you don't necessarily want to give them permissions to do all the crazy dangerous stuff, so maybe you write a little tool or something? Yeah? This is a really great feature of remoting. In PowerShell 3, you can create a new configuration file. This defines what an endpoint can do. It's just a file that sits on disk, but you can tell it, look, in this particular endpoint, I want these modules to load up. So whenever someone connects to this endpoint, I want to automatically load certain modules, like an Active Directory module or whatever functionality you need it to load. However, I don't want the person to be able to see all of those commands. I only want them to see the commands that I want them to see. So you can get extremely specific with the capabilities that this endpoint will offer. Then, once that definition file is sitting on disk, you register it with WinRM. This will cause the WinRM service to restart briefly. It has to register this endpoint, so this is not something you want to do when 20 other people are connected trying to manage the server. You'll tick them off and they'll come after you. But you give it the name of that file that you just created, and you can set the security descriptor. And the easiest way to do this is just with the show security descriptor UI so that it pops up the little dialog box. There's show security descriptor UI. But you can specify a run as credential, meaning only these people can connect to the endpoint, but I don't want you to use their credential to run the commands. I want you to use this credential instead. So I'm only giving them the tools I want them to have, so they'll only be able to do the things I've defined, and I want them to happen with this elevated account, but I only want these people to be able to do it. So you can set up some really cool stuff, and there's nothing stopping you from building a GUI that accesses all this under the hood. Knowing that even if someone kind of does an end run around your GUI and connects to this thing directly, they don't have any extra capabilities. This thing is totally locked down to whatever you needed it to be locked down to. This is something you're definitely going to see people using a lot. Microsoft already uses this. Anybody have O365, Office 365? Yeah? So you know you can PowerShell in and you can get a remote command line on Microsoft's Exchange servers, which is awesome. But you can only do the few little precious things that they allow you to do to your bits of the environment. So you can get really, really creative with this and do a lot of cool delegated things. This is one of the reasons you're starting to see, especially like in the Windows 8 Server 2012 timeframe, you're starting to see GUI consoles using PowerShell under the hood because it allows you to set up so much and creative in the way of delegating and getting very specific about who can do what, supporting a lot of different scenarios. You know, I want a lot of my customers, even if they're internal customers, to be able to PowerShell in and do stuff, but I want to limit the specific things each of them can do. So you can get very, very creative with this. So this remoting really is a foundation that a lot of cool things are being built on top of. It's definitely worth your time to check it out and investigate. So does it work on just groups? Yeah, you can set the SDDL, the security descriptor, up for whatever you like. You can load in groups. The default one was the administrator's group, not an individual user. So yeah, groups, obviously smarter way to do it, definitely. So look, I'm going to let you guys go. If you've got any last questions you want to ask and you want to walk up and ask, you're more than welcome to. Please do complete your session evals. Those are real important to helping me do a better job next time and to help the conference organizers plan really good content for next year. So let them know what you thought of it. And please dive into this. Go right home and start doing your planning for this. It is a planning process. I get that. But get that happening so you can be ready. Thank you.